From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When you see the images of Tim Hetherington, most of us would say he was a photographer and a war correspondent. But that's not how Hetherington himself saw it, though it wasn't easy for him to explain his work. He did travel to some of the world's most dangerous places, and he did capture the images of war in stills and on video. But in a new documentary about Hetherington's life, the journalist Chris Anderson says those pictures weren't about war, they were about human nature. Today in the program, the writer and journalist Sebastian Junger is among our guests. His film is premiering at Sundance this year. It's a personal project for Junger. Hetherington was a friend and a colleague. He was killed by mortar fire in Libya in 2011. The film is about Hetherington's art, about his unique perspective, and his deep connection to his subjects. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In April of 2011, the filmmaker and journalist Tim Hetherington was killed by mortar fire in Libya. He had been covering the civil war there, and he bled out in the back of a pickup truck on his way to the hospital. His friend and colleague, Sebastian Junger, has created a documentary about Hetherington. In 2010, the two co-directed the film Restrepo about the remote and dangerous military outpost in Afghanistan's Korangal Valley. Junger's film does deal with that allure and the risk of covering war, but really this is a personal portrait of Tim Hetherington's life and his work. It's about his unique artistic perspective of war, how he looked for and captured images that expressed conflict but weren't the pictures most of us were expecting. Hetherington was never detached from the people he was photographing. He talked to them, he reached out to them, and being engaged was part of his art and part of his process. Today in the program, we're back in Park City as we continue our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival. We're talking about Sebastian Junger's film. It's called Which Way is the Front Line from Here? The Life and Time of Tim Hetherington. Sebastian Junger is with us. He is a writer, journalist, filmmaker, of course. Among his books are War and The Perfect Storm. And Sebastian Junger, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Also, the producer, James Brabazon, is with us. He's a journalist, a documentary filmmaker. He collaborated with Tim Hetherington on the 2003 documentary project, Liberia, an Uncivil War. He's also the author of a memoir called My Friend, the Mercenary. And James Brabazon, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you.
We should mention there are still three Sundance screenings of Which Way is the Front Line from Here? And the film debuts on HBO in April. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. And we should also mention today we're broadcasting, as we have been all week, from the studios of community radio station KPCW in Park City. Sebastian Junger, let me start with you. Do you remember your first impression when you first met Tim Hetherington? Like, was there something unique about him right off the bat?
I do remember my first impression. It was quite startling. I was on this project to follow a platoon off and on for a year in combat. And on my second trip in, I was assigned to work by Vanity Fair to work with Tim Hetherington. I sort of picked him out of a list of possible colleagues. I needed someone who was very experienced in combat. And as I said to him on the phone, I need someone who's really fit. And Tim said, well, I'm rather lean. You'll find out when you meet me. I'm rather lean. And indeed he was. I was at Heathrow Airport on my way in, and he came striding into the gate. And I kind of knew he was there because I was reading the paper or something, and I just sensed that everyone at the gate was looking in the same direction. Right. And I looked up, and in he came, you know, working three cell phones at the time with this huge stride. He was about 6'4". And just very open, engaged, bright, dynamic person. I just liked him instantly.
Yeah. How do you describe your relationship with him?
Well, I said at one point during the sort of fanfare of Restrepo, after that came out, in an interview, I said working with Tim was like getting into a little red sports car and driving around really fast. I mean, his mind was so fast and engaged and open and curious. I mean, and he just couldn't go fast enough. I mean, he just like, he loved the world and he led a really big life. And he just tried to experience this incredible world more fully than anyone I've ever seen. Mm. And so working with him, well, I mean, we each brought different things to the relationship, but he just expanded me. He just expanded my mind with his vision, with what he saw in the world. And it was absolutely extraordinary to be alongside him sometimes.
James Brabazon, how do you describe your relationship with Tim?
Well, it was a very close working relationship. I mean, we started working together in Liberia in 2003. And up to that point, I'd been covering the civil war there alone. And Tim had called me, cold called me, actually, out of the blue, and said, look, you know, I hear you've got this fantastic exclusive, and I'd like to come along and do it with you. So my kind of immediate reaction to that was, absolutely no way.
this is my much. Story.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's my story. Yeah. Thanks, but no thanks. And we met up. He persuaded me to meet up for a cup of coffee in central London. And it turned out we'd both taken photographs at the Martin Milguy School for the Blind in Sierra Leone.
Yeah.
And we started talking, and there was just this immediate connection and got along really well. And I found myself at the end of this meeting, after having a couple of cups of coffee after an hour, saying, yeah, sure, you can come with me.
Yeah.
Like, what am I doing? but professionally, it was like really expanding, because suddenly we're on location together, and everything that I could do as an individual filmmaker was suddenly multiplied. So the possibilities of what we could do together suddenly had just radically expanded when we got together in the film and started working.
Well, so you obviously hit it off. I mean, you were, he seemed like an engaging guy, but was it also the imagery? Was it his work that was compelling right off the bat for you as well? Did you notice that at first? Like, he's doing things that are really interesting or different.
Well, originally, of course, it was actually hard to see where his work was going, because after I met up with him, I looked at his back catalogue from when he was with Network Photographers, which was a lot of sort of slightly more traditional black and white photography from West Africa. Very challenging, very interesting. But it was when we got to Liberia together, and he was then photographing exclusively in colour, that it was very clear that the details he was focusing on were not the details you would expect a war photographer to focus on.
Yeah.
And it became very apparent very quickly that Tim wasn't really a war photographer. He was a photographer working in war. And his eye for the little things that would tell the story of the Civil War, and importantly, the people who were fighting it, suddenly it became clear to me that it's a different kind of work altogether.
Yeah. Sebastian Younger, if I may, could I ask how you got the news of Tim's death? I know that you had received a phone call. This was the morning of April 20th, and there had been some rumor that Tim had been hurt.
Yes, I got a phone call from a mutual acquaintance, something to the effect of, Tim's been hurt. Something's happened in Libya. And I'd had a lot of misgivings about his trip. I was supposed to be with him on assignment for Vanity Fair. At the last minute, I couldn't go for personal reasons. He went on his own. And when I heard he was going into Misrata, I really had a sort of weird sense of dread. I don't know why. And so when I got the phone call, in a weird way, I wasn't surprised. It was I was shocked, but I wasn't surprised. It was strange. And so I immediately, I don't spend a lot of time on Twitter, and I don't know what guided my hand, but the first thing I did was check on Twitter. And there was a tweet saying, Tim Hetherington has died just now. And it was from Andre Leon in the hospital in Misrata. And it took a while to confirm that.
Yeah.
But within an hour or so, like, we knew for sure.
I'm interested in, you've talked before about the fact that during a lot of his friends and colleagues had come to New York for this memorial service in New York, and it was there that you, as I understand it anyway, wanted to talk to them. And I wondered, what was it that you wanted to know? Did you have something in mind that you were trying to learn about that?
Well, you know, I was a good friend of his, and I'm a journalist, and both of those things sort of guided me, I think. But I had a lot of questions about how he died, what went into the decisions that they made to go out to that spot that was obviously so dangerous, even if maybe it didn't seem dangerous. I just had a lot of sort of journalistic questions, I guess, and the reporters who survived the attack, one of them was wounded, Mike Brown, they were all going to be in New York for the memorial that I helped organize, and I thought, okay, I've got them all in one place, I'm just going to interview them. And if I'm going to interview them, let's do it with a video camera rather than a tape recorder.
Yeah.
And so I got them into a studio at Goldcrest Films where we made the film on Tim. And they were just traumatic, raw, very painful interviews about a very, very traumatic event. And I thought, wow, that is actually – they reminded me of the interviews that Tim and I did for Restrepo with the soldiers.
Yeah.
And I thought that is actually the basis for a really powerful film if we can do it. And then we set out to get the footage that was available. Tim had been shooting video the whole day in a lot of very serious combat that whole day before he died. I mean, right up until a few minutes before. And we got, I mean, that's the thing now. Everyone's got at least a cell phone camera. So these civil wars are getting covered by the fighters themselves. I mean, there's a huge amount of visual information out there. And so we made use of that. Part of the film was to reconstruct the sort of facts of Tim's death and what happened and reconstruct it visually.
Yeah. At what point did you realize, though, because that is what the film is about in part, but and it's about your relationships with him and, you know, and with his friends. At what point did it occur to you that this was also an opportunity for you to say something about his perspective and his art?
Well, we went into HBO and sort of sold the film. They financed the film, you know, on the basis of like a, you know, 1 hour conversation. I mean, they jumped in immediately and it was really wonderful. And one of the great things about that is that we had access with Sarah Bernstein and Sheila Nevins. We had access to questions about Tim that I wouldn't necessarily have because I knew him so well. And so what started to come out in those conversations was, you know, questions like what was he trying to do with his art and things like that. I'd been in so much combat with him. My sort of like experience with him wasn't really art directed in a sense. You know, I had kind of a bit of a blind spot. But other people didn't, fortunately, and that's why films should be collaborative efforts. And so as we started to put the film together, I had this strange feeling of actually encountering Tim more fully than I had when he was alive, in a weird way. I mean, we were going through his journals and his old photos and, literally boxes of stuff. And I felt like I knew, in some ways, knew him better than I ever had.
James Brabazon, in fact, Sebastian, I want to get you on this question too, but let me start with you. James, what's the gift that he had? Like, what was the talent that he had, do you think? Was it observation? Was there something particular about the way what was the thing that he had that made him good at what he did, do you think?
Fundamentally, the sort of the basis of the way that Tim worked was that he interacted with people as individuals. He was, to say interested in is like a wild understatement. He was obsessed by the common humanity that he shared with other people. So his ability to kind of converse with and have meaningful conversations with people that would ordinarily be just subjects you would meet in passing and allowed him to kind of portray people in a way that was surprising and very deep, but not in a sort of cliched way.
Yeah.
You know, you'd get another layer of someone's personality from his photographs. I'd spent a lot of time filming and photographing the rebels in Liberia. And for me, you know, I saw them really as combatants, as soldiers, as, you know, we were deep in the middle of a very vicious civil war. And I quite like having time to myself away from them. But Tim would take every opportunity he could to sit and talk with people, whether they were teenage child soldiers, the commanding officer. He'd just sit, you know, drink with them, shoot the breeze, smoke a cigarette, take pictures. And it was that ability to communicate, even when there were very few shared words of a common language, that he could somehow draw visually that sense out into the pictures that he was making. It's a very fine sensibility towards not looking at soldiers, aggressors, perpetrators, victims, but always looking at individuals.
He this comes out in the film. The type of camera that he used was related to that. I mean, it was a Rolodex.
He used a Rolleiflex.
Rolodex. No, that's
a great Rolodex as well.
Yeah. A Rolleiflex, and it was interesting because the reason that he used this medium was that it wasn't covering his face. That he had to look at people.
It's a very different way of working. If you're working with medium format camera like a Rolleiflex, which is essentially 1930s technology.
Right.
I mean, absolutely 1930s technology. You're shooting a roll of film. It's paperbacked film, and you're shooting 12 frames on a roll of film. So that means you're reloading every 12 frames, which means that every frame you shoot has got to count, especially if you're shooting those frames in combat. So his way of working, it really slowed him down. So every frame he shot becomes a very compressed moment of time. And I think shooting like that under those circumstances, the fact that it slows you down, the fact that you really have to look, you really have to consider when you're going to make that image, you get this other layer beneath the sort of surface visual impact of what's immediately around you. They're almost like film stills. Yeah. It's really interesting. You get this deeper layer to them, and it was kind of strange, actually. It's a very unusual way to work. I mean, you know, probably no one had been shooting medium format cameras in combat since Kappa washed up on, you know, D-Day beaches. I mean, it's really unusual. At one point, we were on the retreat from Monrovia in a vehicle. We were being ambushed at about 70 yards by government soldiers. We were losing window glass out of our own vehicle. The vehicle behind us had just been taken out with an RPG. And Tim was shooting medium format pictures out the window, saying, "Wow, it's amazing! I can see them; they're so close." I'm like, and I was filming out the front window, saying, "Who can you see? Who's so close?" The government soldiers just sitting there shooting at us. I mean, and then he'd take a roll of film out and pass it over to me, and while he reloaded, I'd be like licking the tape down on the film, right, sticking it between my teeth while I was filming, while he was reloading. I mean, it's a bonkers way of working, but it's bizarrely productive. Because you just get this different layer into it.
Sebastian, what was Tim Hetherington? Because it's so interesting. There's a moment in the film when he says that he's not really all that interested in photography per se. He wasn't crazy about being referred to as a photographer. He wasn't crazy about being referred to as a combat journalist, I don't think, either. How did he describe what it was he was?
I think he took a certain amount of delight in sort of violating people's expectations of what he was supposed to be. I mean, I think he literally set out to just do that intentionally. And you're right. I mean, he didn't like being called a photographer. He thought that photography was a tool to communicate something about the world that interested him.
Yeah.
But he didn't have allegiance to photography per se. If there was a better way to communicate something with video or audio or crayons, for that matter, I think he just would have gone for it. And I think that ruffled some feathers in the photo community. You know, like, wait a minute, you're one of the top photographers in the world, and you don't even want to be called a photographer? Then, what's that make us?
Yeah.
You know? But, I mean, he has such an extraordinary way of thinking, and there's an example of it. We were out at Restrepo, our first day out there, we were in four firefights, and it really, not just a couple of bullets over our head, but really full on, like, enemy fighters coming up into the wire, throwing hand grenades.
Yeah.
And we, after a few days of this, he said, you know, the least interesting thing about combat is combat. What's way more interesting is the emotions that men have and their relationships with each other while they're in combat. And so his book, Infidel, maybe there's one photo of a guy shooting a gun. Everything else is about the bond between the men out there.
I want to play a moment from the film, in fact, because I saw the work that he did at the Coringal Valley with you as kind of a test of this idea of engaging with your subjects. Because in some ways, and you make this point in the film, it would have made sense for Tim to have empathy for the people of Afghanistan. That would have sort of made sense to his sensibilities. But he also applies this perspective and this sense of empathy to the soldiers as well, which again is surprising. Here's Tim Hetherington from the film, Sebastian Younger's film that we're talking about today.
The world was very much focused on Iraq, and I thought that we would be walking around the mountains, we would be drinking cups of tea with elders, we'd occasionally get shot at, and it would be pretty uneventful. But it was completely the opposite.
Right over the ridge, man.
I was completely surprised by the amount of fighting that was going on. These guys were in a lot of combat.
Give me one.
People really hadn't raised their heads up to what was happening in Afghanistan.
Oh, yep.
You good?
Nice, man. I'm good.
He's back there, right?
Yeah, he's what there. Hey, he's still in there. Man.
During that time, what was interesting was that, not to belittle the kind of the fighting, but I got kind of tired of it.
For me, whilst there is a certain amount of adrenaline to do with combat and filming that, I mean, for me, the really important stories are being close to these men. You know, that's what it's about. That's what really I'm there for.
That's amazing. I think you got a sense of what was going on there. And the images are amazing, obviously, to hear them, I guess. But what it was about, I got the sense that in some ways, and maybe this is trite, but for him, it was kind of about that connection. And almost it was like about love for him in some way, that sense of bonding, which you talk about.
Well, one of the guys out there, Brendan O'Byrne, who's the sort of the main subject of my book, War, from out there, he said to me once, and he repeated it to Tim on camera, which was great. He said, you know, there's guys in the platoon who straight up hate each other, but we'd all die for each other. Yeah. And that is a form of, that's brotherhood. And brotherhood's different from friendship. Brotherhood is completely independent from how you feel. It's a commitment where the other person's life is at least as valuable to you as your own is. And that's the thing that makes it very hard for young men to come back from war. They come back and they miss the war. And what they miss isn't the killing and the dying. They miss each other.
Yeah. There's a powerful story that you tell in the film, and I'm trying to decide if I should play a clip of it or have you tell the story. It's this image, the images that he captures of the soldiers there in the Corangal Valley at Restrepo outpost sleeping.
Yeah. It was one day, it was just brutally hot, and we hadn't been in a firefight in a few days, maybe a week, so which was out there was like basically nothing was happening. Yeah. And I was sort of just swatting away the flies, and everyone's just sort of drugged with heat, and it's like mid-morning, and everyone's asleep, right? And just the epitome of like nothing's going on.
Yeah.
So I'm not working, I'm not thinking, I'm just spacing out. And Tim's creeping around with his camera photographing all the soldiers that are asleep. And they're sort of sprawled everywhere, outside, on their bunks, whatever. And I'm like, Tim, man, what are you doing? Like, nothing is happening. And he said, no, don't you get it? You never get to see soldiers like this. You always see them in their gear with their guns looking all tough and, you know, macho. And he said, but this is actually what they really are. They're little boys. And you can see that. When they're asleep, you can see them the way their mothers see them. He said, no one's ever seen that part of the American soldier, of all soldiers. And so he crept around photographing these young men who were asleep, and it's the most extraordinary collection of images. I mean, that's war.
Yeah.
In some ways, that's more war than a guy shooting a gun is. It's a 19-year-old asleep on a bunk.
Sebastian Junger is with us. He directed the documentary, Which Way is the Front Line from Here? The Life and Time of Tim Hetherington. James Brabazon is also with us. He produced the film. Tonight at 9 o'clock and Friday afternoon at 3:30, there are screenings in Park City. The film, we should say, is also showing this Saturday night at 6:45 at the Broadway Center Cinema in Salt Lake City. And April 18th, it debuts on HBO. We should also mention there's an exhibit of Tim Hetherington's photography at the Julie Nestor Gallery in Park City. We'll talk about that a little bit later. That runs through January 30th. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Sebastian Junger is with us. We also have the journalist and photographer James Brabazon with us. We're talking about the Sebastian Junger's film premiering at Sundance. It's a deeply personal project. It's a profile of his colleague and friend Tim Hetherington, who was killed in Libya in 2011. Most of us would call Hetherington a photographer or a war correspondent, but it's not what he called himself. He liked the term image maker. Junger's film is about the risks of covering war these days, but it also attempts to explain his friend to the world. And we should mention that the film is going to be debuting on HBO April 18th. There are also a number of screenings still here at the Sundance Film Festival. We'll give you details about that as we go along. So I wanted to ask you, I want to play another moment from the film, if it's okay. It's right at the beginning of the film, and we hear Tim Hetherington trying to explain to the camera what he is or what he does. So there are a couple of sort of excerpts here. Let's start with this one.
you know, what's interesting about war is that there's lots of generalizations made up about it. But in going to these extremities, that what's interesting is that you see that even in these terrible times, in these terrible moments, in these terrible extremities, that people are still human. I think that that for me is like the redeeming factor of the human experience. No, that sounds too f***ing bullshit.
Well, I think it was good. I think you're almost there.
You know, there's a lot of people who make kind of generic... No, I don't want to say there's a lot of people. No. I think the important thing for me is to make work that is connected to people. You know, I like to... Oh, shit, sorry, man. Blah, 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 blah.
I love that moment. It's right at the beginning of the film, and it gives you a sense of how conflicted he was about trying to express what it was that he does.
Yeah, he was constantly, I think you could almost say overthinking things.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
He would just, but that was so wonderful about him. I mean, he would never just say, okay, that's good enough. You know, he'd sort of do something or say something, and he'd think about it like, oh, that's not quite right. And he could work himself up into really kind of a state.
Yeah.
But it did get him somewhere. It did get him to some more profound place sometimes.
He produced this diary, which if you get a chance, we'll put a link to it on our website, by the way. This and you mention it in the film, this kind of short documentary about, and it's the first time, as he says in the film, he places himself in his work, and it's this sort of contrast about his life and the work that he does. And one thing that he says about it is that he says he goes to these places. I make pictures to understand what is happening there for myself, which I thought was interesting. And I wonder, James, do you think that sort of expresses how personal this was for him, that this was about his journey as much as anything else?
Yeah, his work was deeply personal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of, you know... Tim realized very quickly that the idea that you could be a 6'4" white man working in West Africa and somehow not be intimately involved in your own work was ridiculous. You know, you couldn't blend in. You weren't not there. You were inevitably and inexorably part of the images that you were making. And I think that diary was the sort of professional moment for him to kind of formally incorporate himself into his work. What happened with Tim's career is really it's a journey, it's a trajectory which begins in Liberia and it sort of develops hugely in Afghanistan and then was leading somewhere in Libya. And it's this fascination with young men at war, young men and violence, trying to answer these central questions of how young men see themselves at war and why. And fundamentally, Tim was a young man at war. So as much as his work is trying to understand the motivations of other young men at war, it's also a reflexive study of himself. And in trying to understand what it was about the sort of gravitational pull of war that he found so compelling and why he was compelled to go and make images, that in itself informed the way he looked at the young men that he was photographing.
Here's another moment from the film. Tim Hetherington is talking about this first project. You mentioned it all begins in Liberia. This was in 1999, and it was a project called Healing Sport. And I guess the central insight here, though, James and Sebastian, is that he found other images to explain, you know, privation and war, other ways of expressing it. Here's Tim.
When I went to Liberia, it just blew me away. I'd never experienced a country like that before in my life. And it was 2 years after the end of the Civil War, 2 years into the reign of Charles Taylor, and I went to photograph football as one of the more positive things that was going on in Liberia at the time. Healing Sport was the first coherent project that I made as a photographer. I made it under the idea of Trojan horses. The idea was, can we talk about things that people are reluctant to talk about by disguising them as in other vehicles? And so basically Healing Sport was about war, but it was disguised as sport.
to sort of explain what he was getting at with his art, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think he tried to think outside of the sort of typical pathways that most of us use. And war is a very loaded topic, yeah. And people have very extreme reactions to it. And sometimes it's so loaded that you actually can't even talk about it. People get upset. They don't want to hear it, or they're obsessed with it, whatever. And I think what he found in that project was a way to talk about war, and we don't even know that we are. And that's just sort of classic Tim of sort of finding the content below the form, you know? And so when out at Restrepo, he really was interested in, like, not the combat, but how young men react to combat and why it's meaningful. Why is that meaningful? Why is combat so meaningful? You know, why are they dying to sign up and join a military and go fight? Like, what is that? What is it about young men and about combat that is so compelling?
Yeah. There was early on, Tim went to Sierra Leone, did these series of portraits of people who had been blinded by the rebels there. And James, you say that that was another, I guess, one of these progressions in the way he would come to work. Getting invested, really invested in their lives.
One of the really important things about the Sierra Leone work is that I think it's Tim learning that he has to be very careful about photography becoming an acquisitive act.
Yeah.
What he doesn't want to do is be a big white man who arrives in Africa, takes lots of pictures of the locals, and then takes them back to Europe and publishes them, and that's it.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, what he wanted to do was to take photographs that were also meaningful to the people he was photographing. Now, to make a photograph of a blind person meaningful to that person is, frankly, challenging, especially in those conditions in Sierra Leone. So what Tim conceived of was the idea of one of the world's first Braille photographic books, that he would take photographs and that he would then overlay the pages with transparent Braille type so that the people he'd photographed could experience in some way, in a direct, tactile, visceral way, the photographs that he was making of them. It was the very opposite of being acquisitive. And actually, you can see that that's where he begins his journey in conflict. When he goes back to Liberia after the war and lives there, he sets himself up as a street photographer.
Yeah.
And what he does is, when people come to be photographed by him, he just stands there and people walk past and ask him, what are you doing? He said, I'll take your picture. And what he does is he takes one for himself and he takes a Polaroid of them and gives it to them. That's what I've done. And it's the opposite of, you know, the kind of the cliche of stealing someone's soul with a photograph. It's actually a joint process of revealing something which is as meaningful to the person that's being photographed as it is to the person that's taking the picture.
There's this striking moment in the film where we see some of the video that he shot from some of the fighting there in Liberia, and it's scary, you know, it's really frightening stuff, I have to say. And Tim talks about how frightening it is and how all of these things sort of run through your mind. But then he says, you know, you're wondering, you're feeling some regret. Maybe this time I've really done it, and maybe I'm going to let a lot of people down. But then he says this, he says, you have to just click this part of your brain off. Do you guys think you know what he's talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, being in combat is, I'm sure Sebastian will speak to this directly as well. I mean, you develop an extraordinary focus to the point of tunnel vision. And there comes a point where, which is both a very good thing and a very bad thing.
Yeah.
You need to be focused. You need to be extremely concentrating on what it is that's going on around you. But you also need to have a breadth of vision to literally and figuratively see what's coming at you from the side. And I think what, you know, for Tim, what he realized in combat was that there comes a point where you can't intellectualize it. That bit just needs to be shut down. There then becomes the mechanics of survival. So you are working in an environment which is lethally dangerous, and the priority is to survive that, and your work comes out of that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, fear is necessary for survival, but it's an incredibly unpleasant sensation. And the times I've been deeply scared, it's felt like someone injected me with a needle, you know, by needle with poison. You know, just injected poison into my blood. That's what real fear feels like. And you're not that functional when you feel that way. And if you're going to do something, like, I mean, there were so many times where we were going to do a patrol into an enemy village. I just felt this isn't going to end well. Like, there were so many times I would be unbelievably scared beforehand, and always more scared beforehand than during a firefight. But you have to get yourself up out of your bunk, put your boots on, get your gear on, and walk out the gate. I mean, you have to do those things. And the only way to do them is to shut down the part of you that cares about yourself.
Yeah.
You have to get to a point where you don't entirely care what happens to you. And then you're free of this terrible anxiety about the future.
There's a story, James, you tell in the film, and we see this happening, that raises, for me, a really critical question about journalism, and about whether there's some kind of boundary if you're reporting on war, and whether you should just stand back and watch what's going on, or if you should step in and play some role, and what the risks would be for doing something like that. It's one of the rebel leaders has been convinced that this medic or doctor is a government spy. Let me play this clip from the film because I think it. But I want to talk about this. What you made of this, because it's kind of an amazing moment. Because Tim Hetherington steps in.
Next moment, Tim comes in. He grabs the gun hands of Iron Jacket and starts negotiating for the guy's life. And just says, "Look, you know, this is the only doctor you've got," and really just put himself directly in the path of this. They led the guy off, they didn't shoot him, and very shortly he was back treating wounded at the hospital again.
So, I guess we see war correspondents as dispassionate, and there's observers, and they're seeing what happens, despite all the fact that there's danger involved. But the fact that Tim steps in and does something there, what did you make of that, both of you?
Well, I mean, it was an extraordinary act of bravery. Proper bravery, you know. I mean, getting up and filming in the middle of a firefight can be considered brave or just plain stupid. But to put yourself in harm's way to help another person is just straightforwardly commendable in that respect, I feel. I mean, you know, it's like, the thing was, Tim didn't even hesitate. Didn't even hesitate. He just put himself straight in the way of it. You know, and our reactions were really different. I mean, really, really different to that situation. I'd worked in Liberia for a year before, and it's extremely hard to overestimate the brutality of that conflict. It was like working in an abattoir. I filmed executions, torture, even cannibalism at one point. And I just assumed there would be another execution.
Yeah.
It's another day of fighting. There'll be another execution. I turn around to get in a wide shot. You know, there's part of me that was not overly disturbed that that was happening. And for Tim, that was not an opportunity to start making pictures. It was an opportunity to intervene. And we both treated the wounded rebels in that clinic as well. I mean, the guy that had been carrying Tim's bag as we'd walked into Monrovia had been shot through the head. So we'd had, you know, we had to deal with that as well, with bits of brain matter over us. I mean, it was visceral, deeply, deeply visceral. And, you know, this was, don't forget, this is Tim's first encounter with combat. It's the first time he's been in combat. You know, 5 hours earlier that day, it's the first time that someone had shot at him. And you never know how someone's going to react. I mean, I've been through more firefights at that point than I could remember. But Tim hadn't. And there's always that feeling of like, well, even with trained soldiers, you don't know what they're going to do. You don't know what's going to happen. And it was a remarkable breath of fresh air to work with someone that really had their shit together. Mm. They just knew, he just instinctively had a very good sense of what he was doing.
about you?
Well, ultimately, Tim was out there to be a human being, you know? And he got his photography done in the process. But ultimately, he was being a human being. And I don't think there was ever a moment where he was confused about the two. And it just comes through really dramatically in that situation. But it came through in more subtle ways all the time. Just Tim, you know, a soldier who's a little upset about something and got an email from his girlfriend, whatever. You know, just stopping, asking how the guy's doing. Stuff like that. Stuff that don't – it's things that don't produce a great photo. But it does help in little ways in, you know, the struggle that everyone had out there.
Sebastian Younger is with us. He directed the documentary, Which Way is the Front Line from Here? The Life and Time of Tim Hetherington. James Brabazon produced the film. He's with us as well. Tonight at 9 o'clock, Friday afternoon at 3:30, there are screenings in Park City for the film. It's also showing this Saturday night at the Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake City. You can go to our website for all of the details. And April 18th, it's going to be debuting on HBO. We should also mention there's an exhibit of Tim Hetherington's photography at the Julie Nestor Gallery here in Park City, which runs through January 30th. We're live at the community radio station KPCW. We need to take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with James Brabazon and Sebastian Younger. We're talking about the film, Which Way is the Front Line from Here? The Life and Time of Tim Hetherington. It's premiering here at the Sundance Film Festival. There are a number of screenings left, which we'll talk about a little bit later. You can go to our website, by the way, for the details. We should also mention the film is debuting April 18th on HBO. Sebastian Younger, I want to ask you about Tim's family. We meet his mother and his father in the film, I guess the question I had, his father, the family had traveled a lot. I mean, they moved around a lot because of his father's work. And the question I wonder, did he ever consider any place home?
That's a good question. Did Tim consider any place home? I'm not sure he did. Yeah. I think he had bases more than homes. Hmm. And he would set out from those bases and do his thing out in the world. And he was constantly in motion. I mean, he just never stopped. He was never anywhere more than 10 days, I think. And then he'd come back to his base, which was in New York when he died. I think a home was something that he wanted very badly. I mean, maybe everybody does. But something that I'm not sure he was convinced he could give himself. And I think that was a very central and painful question for him at age 40. Like, can I actually settle down and have the kind of family life that other people have? Like, can I do it? Can I pull it off? And I don't think he was sure if he could.
Well, that's one of the things that comes up, you know. I think it was going to Libya in some way was, I think you put it this way, Sebastian, in the film. I'm not sure if you put it exactly this way, but a way of finding some kind of closure or some way forward to say, I can now move forward. And because he didn't, as you say, he didn't want to be alone. He wanted a family. Can I do that?
I mean, the way he described his project in Libya, we were supposed to be there together, and we weren't, and so he sort of generated his own sort of project for it. And it was going to be the last time he went to a war zone. I mean, he said that at one point. I didn't entirely believe it, and I didn't get the sense he entirely believed it, but he did say it. And he wasn't interested in combat. He was interested in these more thoughtful portraits of young fighters sort of dressed up in the ways that they thought they should look in combat. And he was really interested in this sort of circular thing of young men who have never been to war before acting and dressing in ways that reflect their idea of what young men should look like in war. And those ideas come from Hollywood movies, from media accounts. So he almost wanted to do like a portrait series in Libya. And instead, he wound up like in a burning building with rebel fighters clearing Gaddafi snipers out of the rooms room by room by throwing hand grenades around the corner, like right in the middle of that. Now, that is not the project he set out there to do.
Yeah.
And for me, there's a matter of some confusion and even a little anger. It's like, what shifted? Like, what I mean, I can answer my own question, but what is it about a front line that gets someone who is not a, you know, like wire service photographer who needs to turn his images in by the end of the day? What is it about a front line and the drama of violence and combat that is so irresistible and draws people out into it and destroys them? Like, what is that thing that took my friend?
Yeah. James, do you think you understand that?
Yeah, very well. I mean, you know, it's working in war, working in a frontline capacity. It's a sort of vortex. There is a strong gravitational pull towards violence. Violence is compelling. Violence is interesting. Violence is exciting. Violence is different. If you are in the close proximity of death, you know more sharply than at any other time that you are alive. And I think that I'm very wary of using the terminology of addiction. But it's certainly very compelling. There is a reason why young men go to war. There is a reason why people are interested in seeing what young men do at war. I think Tim understood very clearly the essential dichotomy of his profession. On the one hand, you know, moral voice of the world, witness to war, and on the other hand, a vulture.
Yeah.
And it's that duality of both exposing and experiencing the most obscene acts that men can perpetrate against one another, documenting it, and on the other hand, enjoying the theatre of war. And it's trying to reconcile that I think, you know, I mean, it straightforwardly sucked him into the front line.
I wondered in the film what it was that he was hoping, that what kind of reaction he was trying to get from people in some way. And there's this moment in his diary, for example, where he says, he's talking, I think, on the phone, and he says, if you think when you see my pictures, there is no hope. And then his voice kind of trails off. I got some sense that that's what he was hoping that you saw was in those images, hope. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think he sought out the sort of human dignity in everybody, rebel fighters in Liberia, American soldiers. I mean, you know, a lot of people who are against the war decide to forget that American soldiers have an experience out there too. They have just as much of an experience as the Afghans do. They're human beings, just like they're deserving of full consideration, just like everybody else is.
Yeah.
And Tim, you know, that was where Tim was focused. War is such a loaded thing, and it really, one of the things Tim wanted to do was have an honest conversation about it. And I remember once I gave a talk, and it was to a pretty liberal crowd, I think, and I'm politically very liberal, and so I kind of know those people, you know, in a way. And I said, so who here is horrified by war? You know, of course, everyone raised their hand. And then I said, okay, all right, who here has paid, you know, $12 to go be entertained by a Hollywood war movie? You know, everyone raised their hand. And that's the central contradiction that we really don't like to look at. Like, we're fascinated by something that we all know we should be horrified by. And we haven't worked it out. And Tim was trying to honestly understand that apparent contradiction.
Mm. James, there he says in the film, and people talk about that, I think this was actually before he went to Libya, that he was through with war, that he was done with it. And then he goes back, of course. But was he, do you think? Could he ever be done with it, Tim Hetherington?
The two words that I'm probably most suspicious of are Tim Wood. I don't know. It seems that he was on a journey. His work was on a trajectory. And he was in the process of explaining something, documenting something, elucidating something about the nature of young men and violence. But he wasn't there with that journey. He hadn't finished it. the work from Libya is unfinished. And how he would have chosen to finish that work and where it would have taken him, it's unknowable. I agree with Sebastian. Yes, he said those words. I'm not convinced he believed them himself.
What do you think, Sebastian, finally? About a minute left.
He was very strongly propelled by the human experience, and he wanted to understand it, and he wanted to help it. And I think he had a certain amount of inner conflict and some demons that he felt he could work out in war zones. And I don't think he'd worked them all out yet, and I think he probably would have returned to war zones to continue doing that.
Sebastian Younger. He directed the documentary. It's called Which Way is the Front Line from Here? The Life and Time of Tim Hetherington. James Brabazon produced the film. Gentlemen, thank you very much for the time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tonight at 9 o'clock and Friday afternoon at 3:30, there are screenings in Park City for the film. It's also showing in a Saturday night at the Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake. And April 18th, it debuts on HBO. There's an exhibit of Tim Hetherington's photography here in Park City at the Julie Nestor Gallery. It runs through January 30th. For all the details, go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The show was directed today by KPCW's Mario Heeb. Our thanks also to Simone Cycli back in the KUER studios and our intern, Taylor Almond. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.